The book is called Art, Sex, Music. There are very many copies over there. I will say, before I get round to introducing Cosey, that it's, if anybody wanted to be reminded that success in music is about hard work, this is the hardest working memoir I have ever read. This is the book that tells you that if you want to do anything in life, you have actually got to put 150% into it, and not just for a day, but for, in this case, 40, 50 years or whatever. So, that's why I found it so fascinating. I commend it to you. I recommend that not merely do you buy it, but you stay long enough to have Cosey sign it. And it will be the subject of most of what we've got to have a conversation about. So, where do we start? Well, we start with the name Throbbing Gristle, even though it's not by any means the very first thing that Cosey did. But it's the name that probably stands out in that kind of CV of music involvement that she had over the years. But she started her life in Hull, which, as you know, is this year's capital of culture. She was involved in creating various musical projects there before she moved to London. Then there was the whole Throbbing Gristle period. Then there was the whole period when she broke free of that, and she did a lot under there with Chris Carter under the heading of Chris and Cosey. And then more has carried on. And that, alongside even that, there is a whole career as a solo individual woman artist. And that, if that isn't enough to keep us going for a while in conversational terms, I don't know what is. So would you give a huge welcome to Cosey Panituti? Okay, right. Well, I've done a big announce to the book, right? But the thing that struck me most about, you know, there's a lot of things struck me very strongly about it, but one of them was simply, it is so detailed. There's 500 pages there of a lot of very intricate and very important work done, and you remember the beginnings as much as the ends. You remember the things that happened, you know, back in Hull as much as you remember the things that happened 10 years ago, 5 years ago. What's the trick to remembering all that? How did you remember it?
Well, there is no trick. And I've got a good memory, and it's not been addled by having a really long-term drug-taking lifestyle. So, my brain cells are pretty good because I did my indulgence within 6 months and then got out. So, and also I remember events, and the events are pretty, some of them are pretty full on, so you don't easily forget them. And all the way through working with art, music and everything else is that it's all been documented. I mean, our websites are pretty detailed. So when it came to doing the book, I had all the dates in there ready. I had all my diaries piled up. And if I was in doubt about anything, really lucky thing was that Chris used to keep a diary as well. So, and he offered them, he said, read them if you want. I'd never read them in all the 40 odd years we've been together. Obviously, I wouldn't. But he offered them up for me to, if I said, do you remember this incident? He said, yeah, I wrote about that. And so I had access to that as well. So, yeah, I can remember so much. My friends come to me, my school friends, like Les, who's in the book that I've known since I was about 3 or 4. He comes to me and he wants to hear about our childhood because he's forgotten. So I have to go over what we did. But then he fills in little bits because it triggers the memory in him, you know, so it wasn't that difficult.
Okay, but you kept diaries?
Okay? Yeah.
From what period? I mean, do you still keep a diary?
I do, but it's not in a written book anymore, which I might go back to that now, actually. I'm not sure. I tend to write a lot in emails, and they get really lengthy about my day, and I'll suddenly realise that this is just like a diary entry. So I have a kind of like laptop iMac diary as opposed to a physical one, which I have printed out actually as a backup.
But you know, I keep a diary as well. I've got nearly 40 years worth of it. Mm-hmm. I sometimes think, I wonder why I do it. I mean, it's not because I thought I ever wanted to be remembered.
It was just because it was some kind of reflex in me said, this is probably worth me thinking about after it happened.
Mm.
I mean, did you, when you started, because I think there's some quotes from your, not quite teenage diary, but there's some quite early diary entries mentioned in the book.
Mm.
Did you think then you were doing it for any purpose?
Well, when I was, that was like in the 50s and 60s, and it was a thing for young girls to be given a diary for Christmas. You know, with a little lock on it, as if you couldn't break it into it, you could easily, but, you know, you'd get like a diary or a five-year diary.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of given to me as an activity. And when I was first entered high school, I was told by our English mistress that we would be given a pen pal. So there were all these pen pals from abroad. Mine was from Germany. And so I got into this letter writing about my day, and then with the diary as well, it just became, you know, a daily thing for me.
Mm.
And I'm glad of it, you know.
Oh, likewise. Well, we had a little spat earlier on in the previous panel about remembering things. I don't remember anything. And then you actually think, well, no, actually, it's just a matter of looking around a bit, and it's probably all there if you know where to look for it. And you've got that, because you've got the diaries, you've got Chris's diaries, you've got your emails, you've got a record of a life, and it's all in the book.
Yeah, and we've documented the coup actions as well. We had a film. It was all about, we had a filing cabinet, you know, and there were files on things, files on people that came into coup. So it was well documented.
Mm.
And it was just a matter of bringing it all together and to form a narrative so people could understand how things emerged. Which was what was important to me, is to step into my life from being born right through to, I think it's 2015, it ends the book.
Yeah, well, I'm going to take you to, not quite being born, but I kind of want to concentrate just a little bit on the period when you were in Hull, which I think took you through to, what age did you leave Hull?
I left just after I was 21.
I thought it was 21, yeah. Okay, so the first 21 years of your life were centred around a city which is not merely quite famous at the moment, but it actually had you back, I think, to be in, they've called you back to Hull at various times. So, a famous daughter. Pick up two or three events out of that 20 years that probably give us an idea about what it was like to be you in Hull during that period.
Well, after I'd left school and started work, I suppose that's a good place to start, because my childhood is just... Yeah, it was an interesting childhood with flashes and things in woods, but other than that, there were a lot of weird things going on in my childhood. But if I go through to when I was more or less 17 and I'd started a job as a laboratory technician, I worked in a school giving experiments to kids and working with them through it. And I had to go to day release, and I was out there doing the usual disco thing and not wondering why, I didn't get off on it, you know, at all. And then I met a group of friends at the tech college, and that was it. I just started smoking dope, dropping acid, meeting different people, and that was like my awakening, really. And I met Genesis at an acid test, and from there I moved into what was the Hoho Funhouse, which was an old fruit warehouse right near the pier in Hull. So that was like a hippie commune, which by that point I'd given up drugs as well, but they were all still getting really stoned, and I was kind of like an outsider there, really, because they were all university people as well, and I was just a working class girl from a council estate and just finding my way. And from there we went and got Prince Street. Well, I negotiated by renting and two old houses that had been knocked in together. There were about 17 or more rooms altogether. And we made that into like the Coombe headquarters. So from there, that's where Coombe really began. The concept of it started prior to that, but once we got the building, it just became a whole other thing.
Do you want to explain a little bit more about Coombe for people who don't know about that period of your productive life?
Yeah, well, Coombe began as it was an idea of by Genesis Purich. He'd been with an art collective, a multimedia art collective in London, and then came back to Hull and sort of set up his own multimedia collective as well, which is under the title of Coombe Transmissions. And that's where we started with it, and it was based on, I've learned since as I was writing the book, because the people from the Exploding Galaxy brought out a huge book on it, and I suddenly recognised everything that Coombe was that I didn't know at the time. So yeah, that was a bit of a weird moment for me, but Coombe followed the same premise as that, was that everyone is an artist. You don't need to be able to play an instrument as a musician or be able to paint in a particular technique. So it was very open, democratic collective. And we lived our lives doing art every day, or music. We set up a music room, if you like, drum kits and all the rest of it. The house was decorated like an artwork in its own right, with all the things that had clustered around the activities of Coombe or future projects that we were thinking of. And they would gradually sort of emerge from each day. We'd work on them and then we'd take them out to the streets or the art centre and realise them. And that's how Coombe operated. Everyone was welcome to come in and participate. And if they had fantasies or anything like that, then we would work them within actions that we did so that everybody felt at home with what they were doing. And I made costumes for everybody as well.
Did it work? I mean, you know, when we all talk about ideal situations and we think, here's a cooperative that works, did that cooperative work and properly and for long?
It worked most of the time. But there were arguments within it. There always are when, you know, people want to do something and one person doesn't want to do it. They have an idea of where they want the collective to go, forgetting that that's not what the collective's about. So, yeah, there were arguments. By the end, there were just me and Jen left in the house. So we moved to London.
Yeah, well, tell us about that move to London, because you didn't have to go. What was it that... Well, maybe you did. What was it that tipped you in the direction of leaving a place where one set of things was happening to see if you could make those set of things happen in somewhere else?
Well, like I said, there was only me and Genesis left in the house because the police were very overstaffed in Hull at that time, and they had more time on their hands, really. So they were active in trying to quell us, the Hells Angels, the Skinheads, any outsider groups, so they would target us. And we'd got the ultimatum that we were next. A lot of our friends were already inside for petty crime, for drug dealing, anything like that, different things, assault. Because we mixed with different people in Coombe. The long-term criminals, you know, were part of the Coombe collective at that point. So, yeah, we'd lost Coombe, basically, the group. And also, by that time, we'd done a lot of mail art. We'd got a lot of contacts in London. And we'd worked outside of Hull a few times in Europe when we joined the EU, which is ironic. And I go back to Hull to do something the year that we leave. So I don't know what that means. But, yeah, so we moved to London. We got a guy called Robbie Klasnick had a studio at Martello Street, Space Studios, subsidised. And he was moving to a bigger studio. And he said, did we want his basement one? And it just, everything just fell into place. And we said, yeah, this is the right time. And that's... how we got 10 Martello Street, which then became Throbbing Gristle Studio, Death Factory.
Well, before we leave Hull, and before we leave the 1950s, 60s, there's two questions, really. The first one is, was Hull a good place to grow up in?
I think you always love the city you grow up in, don't you?
Yeah, but was it...
What was special? You slag it off when you're young, you can't wait to get out, but when you look back, you realise, yeah, it was great. It made me who I am. It was a struggle. It was really rough. I mean, the estate I lived on, you know, you had to fight for your position. And I did. So when I came to London, it was nowhere near as hard as Hull, so I settled in quite easily.
So I mean, this Hull that's now being sold to the world as the, you know, as a special kind of place...
Mm.
You are actually part of the specialness of it in some ways, aren't you? I mean, you cherish memories that are very whole, I would guess.
Yeah, I can't remember which artist it was that went along to do something as well, and he said the same as me, that he finds the things that he treasures most about Hull are in the fabric of the old buildings, And when they tear them down, or they, you know, the regeneration of it has begun, and they've torn some of the most wonderful buildings down, you know, that's kind of sad. And he, like me, I went looking for the ones that survived, because that was my hope. And go to the council estate, that never changes, you know. But where I lived in Prince Street, the old town, which I think is where I lived, has got a conservation order on it now, I think. And also the whole funhouse has been torn down just about 2 years ago. But all those bond warehouses was our stomping ground, because we lived in the city centre, and half day closing Thursdays, Sunday all day closing, and it was all ours.
Well, listen, let me just jump in with that one, because sometimes, because we travel step by step by step, we forget how different things were. But I mean, you mentioned the police, you mentioned Hell's Angels, but there's a huge amount of, in the book, to be read, there's a lot of stuff about sexism, there's an awful lot of, I mean, they were very different times, weren't
they? Yeah.
I mean, you know, what stands out for you as the thing you can't believe almost happened in those days, because things have changed so much?
Well, I don't know, I think there's still sexism around.
Oh, yeah.
It's just a little, you know, a little bit more subtle than it was then. But, yeah, it was really obvious but I didn't think of it like that. You see, I'd come out of a home that was rigid. My father just ruled the house, that was it. And his word was, you just did that or you got out, which is what happened to me, because I wouldn't. I mean, I think we were just, like, too similar. I mean, I was as determined as he was. And you had your life sort of laid out for you back then, that you're a daughter, you were going to go to school, never mind the qualifications or university, you come out, you work, you get engaged, you get married, you have children, and then it all starts happening again with your children. And I just had no intention of doing that. I don't know why, I don't know whether it was pressure of television or anything like that, I have no idea what it was. But I just, even at 14, when he mentioned marrying me off, I just said, I'm not going to get married. If I want to be with someone, I'll just live with them, because then I can just go when I want. So it was difficult, and it was hard to be on the outside in Hull, definitely. I mean, walking through the council estate in the clothes that I wore, I always got hassled. You know, like anyone does it. Dresses differently. It's not so bad now.
One thing that struck me about it was you talk about this nighttime street life in the whole district, but particularly in the centre, and how there was so much violence, there was so much laying into each other, which was very... Is that something to do with the seaport?
I think it is, yeah. I mean, the trawlermen had come back, you know, get suited and booted, pissed up, fight. Luckily, they dropped the wage packet off with their wife before they went out. And then they'd go back out again. And that was the culture of Hull. And from that, with the children that grew up with all that violence, came skinheads and Hell's Angels, rockers. The mods were violent as well in Hull. But it was like almost as if you go out on a Friday and Saturday night, you get drunk, you have a fight, then you get a Chinese takeaway, and it's been a good night. You know?
Yeah. And that has changed a bit. I don't know.
Yeah, but I think it's still around, isn't it?
Well, it is, yeah, all right. So something's never changed. Right, well, let's move on. We've speeded you through the whole period, but partly because I said to you before, we were talking before, I said one of the projects I would like you most to tell us about and reflect on is the project that became called the Prostitution Project. And we will come back to the work with bands, and we will come back to the music side of it. But the one thing, you ended up in art galleries at a very early stage, and you were adopted by the art world and got Arts Council grants and things. And it was because you pursued a project, well, it wasn't only, but you pursued a project which was about a woman's body, about a woman's right to do what she wants to do with her body, about what it was visibility of the body, about taking charge of it, and so on and so on. That whole thing that's gone on really and probably has never stopped in your artistic career, has always been, could be under the heading of the Prostitution Project. And I think it would be really interesting to people if you could kind of sketch in how that came about and what you thought you were doing.
Well, the 60s were the time of liberation, and then women's liberation came out of that, which I didn't have any real interest in. I was already felt that I was liberating myself. So you had the sexual revolution almost. I say almost because I'm not so sure it was for women as much as it was for men, because they didn't have the fear of pregnancy as women, and then got the pill if they were lucky. But it wasn't as easily accessible as people think. So there was still pressure on women back then not to get pregnant if you didn't want a child and so on. But as far as all the sex industry work that I did as my artwork, it all began with my lifestyle and that exploring my sexuality and the freedom to do that, which, you know, I'd come from a home where I was told basically that I just had to be with one man for the rest of my life, and preferably the first man that, you know, proposed. So I was out there doing things anyway, getting to know who I was, what my body meant to me, if you like, what it was like to have sex even. And then there was all the thing with the sex magic and stuff like that going on, which contributed to it. The male art then came in with us collaging sex magazines and just looking at it. It's just one of those moments where you just look and you think, I could be cutting around my own nude body here in a sex magazine for my own collage. Now, that would be a pure, honest work, you know, that I've actually gone out there and done it myself, come back and collage myself. And it's been inspired by something else, obviously, but it's also a big part of my exploration of my sexuality. I'll take on that project as well, and that could be part of it. And so I started, a member of Coombe came through, was at St Martin's in London doing photography, and he came through to Hull on one of the several occasions he came through. Men Only magazine are doing a competition for a sexy photo. Do you want to do it? So I never posed nude before in my life. So I said, yeah, all right then. So we went in what was the drum room then and took photographs. He took photographs of me. What we thought would be interesting for Men Only. But I was laid on a Victorian cast iron dentist chair in suspenders and stockings. That was all right. The dentist chair was a bit weird. But then we put one of the guys we called Fizzy Pete in there, who was in his clown costume and roller skates. And then another girl, Elizabeth, who had plaits like Heidi, but right down here, blonde plaits. And one of those weird masks that they use a lot now but didn't then on. And thought, yeah, that's really interesting. I think they'll like that. And of course they didn't. They just said it wasn't what they were looking for.
That wasn't the end of you being photographed. It was just the start.
It was the start, yeah. But we spent about a week with Gaylib Street Theatre in London in Notting Hill one summer, and I met a transsexual there called Bobby, and she was a revelation. She was beautiful. I don't mean physically, but just a beautiful person. And she was in Curious magazine. They did a feature on her. And Curious Sex magazine was unusual in the way that it also featured articles on, like, David Bowie, Captain Beefheart. So it crossed over. And I thought, I'll approach them next time. So I sent them a couple of photographs, and they just said, when you're in London, come and see us, which I did when we moved. And I did a photo shoot for them, and ironically, that was the prostitution article that we used for the ICA exhibition. It's the first time I'd appeared in a magazine, and that's why it was used.
Then you carried that on because sometimes you were working to earn the money for the household. Mm. Actually, most of it came from you and your various assignations, shall I call it, but moments where you were actually involved doing the sex work, really.
I was in Hull. I worked different factory jobs because they paid like two or three times as much as an office job. I mean, it was the point of my GCSEs, you know. I could just go and work in a car parts factory or something and earn more money. So I did that to get money for art projects anyway. But when I got to London, the modelling didn't, it was so sporadic, it wasn't like every week you get something, two or three jobs. I did work as a secretary and wages clerk in a dress factory just near the studios, and I took on the modelling as well at the same time. And then I had to give up the job because I was going to auditions all the time with my portfolio and I couldn't keep up with it. But yeah, it was a, it didn't pay the bills as much as you'd think because it was sporadic. So it wasn't a regular income in that respect. But yeah, it helped with the project enormously, and it also was my project. So it was, it had two functions really, two purposes. And I went out there and solicited every genre of sex magazine, the small pocket-sized ones that the guys could take around with them into the woods or wherever they want to go, and then the semi-glossy ones, and then the high-end penthouse and stuff. So it was important to do all of them.
But even that wasn't the end of the... Well, it might have been the end of what you call the prostitution project, but it wasn't the end of your explorations of the kind of sex industry, was it?
No, no.
What followed?
Well, I met a photographer when I was doing that called Zabo, and he was quite different to all the other guys. He was American for a start, and all the others were from London. But he was he'd come from New York, and he knew Ginsberg and Burroughs, and he had all this stuff on his around his fireplace, all this different Crowley and all different kind of things. I'm thinking, oh, this is, you know, a bit weird. And we got talking, and we ended up doing a really nice collaborative photo sessions together. He was brilliant. But after that, after the ICA, I went into doing striptease.
Yeah, tell us about that a bit, follow it on. And then that wasn't the end of it either, but let's do the striptease and then move on from that.
Yeah, when I was doing the modelling, there was a girl I worked with who was doing two girls actually that were doing striptease, and I was talking to them about it. One was doing just like stag parties, which were a bit dodgy, and one was doing pubs around London, you know, doing topless dancing and going around with a pint glass jug, collecting money to do a full striptease. And we'd been going to the Arabian Arms, which is just up the road from where we lived in Hackney, where they did those. They had drag nights and then they had striptease dancers as well. So we'd often go in there and have a look and see how it was going on. And I just really got interested in the whole... the presentation of it was very different to the modelling, because a modelling obviously is so static and stylized, and stripping, and I realized just how much the stripping was as well. There's nothing like the strippers in Soho. I mean, they were very, very different. The pub ones had to appeal to the guy coming in his lunch hour, you know, and it was quick and snappy. And the music you had to dance to had to have some kind of resonance with them as well. So it was kind of a public communication with them, not like the sex magazines at all. It had a totally different reason for being. And I'd always loved dancing anyway, and I was really into music, and I hadn't done it for so long. We didn't go out partying much. And it almost gave me a chance to party every lunchtime, Monday to Friday, you know. I could just dance and really enjoy myself and just take my clothes off at the required time. But I enjoyed doing stripping. I enjoyed doing the sex work as well. I met a lot of really good people there. A whole new circle of friends in both places.
But the thing that marks it off is because a lot of people maybe have done that, well, have done that, but you pursued a parallel career as an artist and you were processing all of that. Mm. There was photographs, I mean, in the book, there's lots and lots of descriptions of you taking those images and rearranging them, contexting them, producing them on different media. In other words, as I understand it, you were doing it because you had got an artistic take on it. In other words, it would be part of the thing which you could express to the world.
I didn't think about expressing it to the world. It was, you know, my life was my art. You know, we've spoken about this earlier. And that was what I was doing. I was exploring myself feeling my way through the world as me, not necessarily as a woman. I never think of myself as a woman artist or a woman musician. I'm just out there doing what I do. And I think we're talking about this retrospectively now, when there's been a lot of analysis of it in terms of feminism and just art in general. And at the time, you know, people say to me, like you've asked me about doing it, it's get up in the morning, and I just did it. I didn't have a like, right, this is what I'm going to do. I'll make a list of what I'll do, and then sometime in the future, I'll do this with it. That's not the way I work with my art. My art is a daily thing with me, and it gradually evolves into something. And at some point, it's exhibited or it's not exhibited. It's just with me in the house. And it just so happened that we knew the guy that was the director of the ICA. We'd done a few things as he worked at art centres around the country. And we said that we were ending Coombe at that point. And he said, well, why don't you do a retrospective and Cozy show your magazines and the mail art? And so we worked towards that. And I started collecting all the magazines. I was collecting them anyway. I'd shown him these. And that's when I extracted my image from the magazines as my art action and framed them up as artworks for the prostitution show.
I'm right in saying that quite a lot of that stuff and what's been produced since is in collections now, isn't it? I mean,
yeah.
You know, art galleries have got collections involving stuff that you produced during that time, haven't they?
Yeah, Tate, museums, Museum of Modern Art and places.
Yeah, so actually you have legacy left as this thing from a project.
Yeah, but it's just, it's happened in its own time and in its own right, and I think that's that feels good to me. I don't produce art to get into museums. It finds its place there because suddenly it has resonance with people. Its place in history is there.
Is it finished as a project? I mean, you know, that continuity through, or, I mean, do you see it as past?
Well, I'm going to go out and do a granny strip-up-gram or something project.
I don't know. I mean, you know, you changed it so much over the years, it might still have some kind of manifestation in what you do.
Yeah, you're right. That at the moment, as I revisit them, I see them quite differently.
Mm.
Definitely. And things start to make more sense to me when I look back at them. In terms of when I was doing it and the now. And so, yeah, they have almost more of a place now than they did when I actually was doing the actions. Definitely. And for me too.
I wanted to concentrate on that because that's a project that is very much you. I mean, a lot of the rest of the stuff you did was in partnership, in groups, in collectives and everything else. Let's just have a little pause and do something that I know the audience will probably want me to do. There are two names that must have a story behind them. One of them is the one you use, which is Cozy Fanny Tutti. And the other one is Throbbing Gristle. And you would say, well, they're not the most obvious names to have picked out of a hat to live your life by or to make music to. Can you tell us the story of those two names?
Cozy Fanny Tutti came from Genesis. When he first saw me, he didn't know my name, and he called me Cosmosis, and I've lately found out where that came from. That came from when he had a vision about Coombe Transmission, and he was told that to actually instigate Coombe Transmissions, he had to find a biological female, and she would be called Cosmosis. I've just found that out. Because I did the whole exhibition we did, the Coombe Transmissions exhibition, I did a small portrait of each Coombe member, the ones that I could find, the first ones, including Genesis. And he explained that. And in all those years we were together, I never knew that. So I know that now, that I was the trigger point for Coombe Transmissions when he saw me. Called me Cosmosis, then it got shortened to Cozy. Then the mail art started, and I'm writing as Cozy. And then Robin Klasnick sent me a postcard with a pun on the name of Cozy Fanny Tutti, Cozy Fanny Tutti, and it stuck. And I thought, yeah, I can work with that.
And you have.
And I have, yeah.
Okay, Throbbing Gristle.
Throbbing Gristle came from Les, and it was prison slang for a hard on. the same as five knuckle shuffle was prison slang for masturbation. It was a TG track title.
Yeah, and you went together, you went for it as a name for a band.
Yeah, because we knew people would have trouble going in a record shop and asking for the latest Robin Gristle album. So, what's the worst name you can call a band?
Okay, and it worked.
Yeah, it did.
Before we move on, there's something that I know a lot of people won't know about unless they've read the book. Can you just give a brief description of what male art involved?
Male art was freeing art from being precious and from the galleries and being a commodity, if you like. We sent artworks to one another right across the world, through to America, everywhere, which was quite unusual then, actually, in the late 60s, early 70s. And these were gifts to one another. And it was going against the norm at the time, just sending anything we wanted. And it got to the thing where you'd send a brick with someone's address on it and things like that. You'd get really sort of like, people go over the top and then you get into trouble from the post office. I'm not mailing that, it would come back. And all kinds of artworks went across the world to one another, and it became quite a big movement, so much so that then what happened was that there was Vile and File magazine, which was a pun on Life magazine of the time, and they had really kind of hardcore stuff in there. And in the back, though, they had a contact list for everybody, so that there was a huge, like, community of male artists, and then asking for works for different shows that they were doing in their own right. But then, as usually happens, you know, people think, yeah, like with, you know, Record Store Day, starts off independent, then they all come in because they see the money, and the galleries started picking it up and doing proper gallery shows of male art, and that's when I opted out, like a lot of people. But that's how it started out. It was kicking against the gallery system and making art free again for everybody.
Okay. We'll turn to the music. Music now. We'll deal with the music that was produced through that period in a minute. But one thing that... Well, this is an evening of punk survivors. One of the several reasons that you're not... We didn't include you in the same panel as before, partly because you've got your book out at the moment, but also because Throbbing Gristle and Since and Before really didn't associate very much with punk. In fact, there's a very small bit in the autobiography where you talk about how a kind of connections were offered with it, and you kind of turned them down and decided to plow your own furrow. What was it about punk that didn't work for you, or you and the group?
I just didn't... It didn't do anything for me.
Musically, you mean in hearing it?
Yeah, I'd come from... To me, it was just like raw rock and roll for me. I'd come from, like, Beefheart, which was heavier, Frank Zappa, Velvet Underground, which was more punkish, if you like. But I was just on a different path completely. We'd already started doing a lot of experimental music, because Chris had got on board by then, and he'd started building synthesizers and effects units. And my head was in a totally different place where music was concerned to punk. I wasn't there. For the fact that we didn't think that you needed to be able to play an instrument, and there was a formula to punk, whereas we were against any kind of formula. So, I mean, we had a lot of punk friends. They were always coming around the studio and they'd rehearse at Martello Street. So it wasn't like we just didn't have nothing to do with them. Because, I mean, Mark Perry was a close friend of ours as well at the time. So we know loads of people. John Cravine, I was talking to Don about it. John Cravine was our friend who opened Boy Boutique down King's Row. He was our friend from Hull. You know, he took one of the first photographs of me and Jen when we were together. So we had a real close connection with punk, but it was kind of not the public music side of it. We just knew the other side of it, really.
And what you were doing was very different. I mean, I'm going to ask you to say how you think it was different in a minute, but for me at least, this idea of... there was a lot... there was this gradual accumulation of technology. It became about the ability to process effects and everything else. It was a creating a kind of torrent of sound which didn't fit into many categories at the time. It didn't seem like music that anybody else was making at the time. I mean, what... And that was pre-Throbbing Gristle, and then it was Throbbing Gristle, and it carried on after that. There's always been that legacy of the torrent of sound created through heavy means, and actually also very loud. I mean, you made a very great deal of the sheer sonic assault of it all.
Yeah, we were really interested in how sound could physically affect you. I mean, forget about going to a gig and expecting certain kind of riffs or anything like that, or even lyrics. So you'd come in and the sound would be something you'd never heard before, so you had no way of assimilating it or trying to place it in a pigeonhole of any kind. I mean, we didn't always know what we were going to do either. I mean, we'd have run-throughs at the studio just to see what the gear could do in terms of how far we could push it and so on. So that was what we were interested in, is that making a sound that actually had a physical effect and in so much as, you know, making your stomach almost turn over and that kind of thing. And that's what we were interested in. We weren't interested in entertainment. That's the big difference. Or revolution in the way that you can think of the anarchy of punk. Our revolution was kind of internalised in our world, I suppose.
So if you have the revolution and you emanate that as music, it might have some effect on the people who are in the room with you?
I think it's a revolution in how you approach and listen to sound. That's what I meant. I didn't mean it like political. It's when you go in and you have no reference point for something that's been blasted at you through the speakers. You suddenly have to kind of take it for what it is and find some... The brain works in a different way trying to assimilate it. And that's what I was interested in displacing people with the sound that we made, rather than making it a collective... Well, it was a collective thing because everybody had the same kind of, you know, what the hell's going on? Even us, you know, on the stage.
At its peak, Throbbing Gristle was four people, four very interlocking but not necessarily completely consonant people. How did it feel to be on the inside of a rather dissonant musical enterprise that sometimes I've got the feeling from the book could have fallen apart at any time?
Oh, it was always falling apart. Always falling. The equipment was falling apart. The four of us were, you know... It was hard to keep us all together for different reasons, you know. It was really, really difficult. But I think that charged the music as well, you know. When you try hard and to get something, it does have a kind of energy to it that you don't get if you're all just like nice mates, you know, just like banging out things. No, we had a lot of arguments.
And it was quite punishing what you put yourself through. I mean, I might have said some part of the prostitution project was also, but it was very punishing the amount of sound you enveloped yourself in, the amount of equipment you hauled over the place, the amount of strain and stress of getting two gigs abroad, coming back, legalities, everything else. I mean, I can't think of a more punishing musical life, and yet...
But it was exciting as well. The whole thing is when you're doing something that you believe in and you think is great, you don't think of, this is hard work, I don't think I'll bother. You know, you just, I mean, even just building the speakers, the big bass bins, and then not being able to get them out of the studio.
Yeah.
That was really mad. But you're so excited, you think, yeah, bigger, bigger. And, oh, shit, no, it's too big. So... I think you're just on a roll and you just keep going with it. You don't think I didn't think of giving up. I just wanted it to work, and you just sort of glue everything together again and carry on, because it's just so exhilarating and exciting thinking you're on the verge of something new you've never heard before. Chris was forever bringing things to the studio. He'd be working till 2 or 3 in the morning on little gadgets, and then he'd come in and put them through the speakers. And it was just like, wow, you know, and then you'd push everything else through it and see what you could do.
And all that proceeded in parallel to actually about four or five musical, in quotes, revolutions. Because we went from punk, we went to post-punk and new wave, we went through, we went into acid house, but we went through the disco thing and everything else. And all the time, your music is pursuing this really quite determined furrow, which is what I would have said was completely separate from all the rest. But actually, I did recently listen back to an interview which Genesis did about acid house. So, I mean, I know that these things were not separate, but how much of the rest of the musical world were you aware of while you were, you know, going down this highway very fast?
Yes, I'm always aware of it, but the thing with me is that I purposely never wanted to learn to play a musical instrument. My father sent me to piano lessons, but I wasn't that impressed. So after that, I just wanted to be free to create a sound that expressed how I felt and to my ear, sounded right for that specific purpose. And that wasn't any of the genres that were already out there. I mean, when we started out with doing the Chris and Cozy material and going into TR-808 and things, no one was using those then. But by the time we'd worked our way through that, that had been picked up and we'd moved on to something else. And I'm not the kind of person that wants to think, right, if I do this, I'll get a hit and then, yeah, I'll be doing all right with that. It's just not why I do it. I mean, Jeff, John Balance from Coil once said to me when we were doing all the electronic Chris and Cozy material, why don't you just, you could just do this, stood on your head, you'd make a fortune. That's not doing it anymore, we've moved on, and I'm not interested in that anyway.
Well, a question that I asked the panel before is, what is your main point of concentration now? Point of concentration in terms of creativity, because once an artist, always an artist, and I think that stands for you. What is the artist known as Cozy Fanny Tutti concentrating on now, artist-wise?
I'm doing a remix at the moment for another band.
Yeah?
So, yeah. I've left Chris sorting out all the tracks while I'm coming in. But, we're going back in the studio now because it took me now 2 years to write the book, and then there's all the editing and that goes on after it. So there's a lot of material in sitting waiting to be finished or mastered. So I've got to get some free time at some point in the next month or two to really sit down and do that. And also I've got a solo exhibition coming up as well in September in London, so I've got to work on that as well.
What will that be?
That will be there'll be a new work in conjunction with material that I did with Zabo in the late 70s, early 80s.
The thing I get from it all is that you kept a record of almost everything. That's what I started off the whole conversation with, was, you know, where do you remember these things? Mm-hmm. Well, we documented, we kept, we were aware that we should also keep something alongside the moment and the rest of it. Does that tie you down at all, so that you are reprocessing things from the past, or is that where the strength comes from?
No, it doesn't tie me down at all, because I'm always constantly generating new work, and it's only when I come to exhibitions, or people come to me and say, I'd like to show X work, that I then look back on it and refocus on the different aspects of it in relation to the theme of the exhibition that they're doing. That's what's interesting to me, is hearing from other people what my work has come to represent to them, which are totally unexpected for me.
Is it? Yeah.
Yeah, because I never saw it when I did the magazine Actions as a feminist work. And when I'm putting exhibitions now, I can understand why it's seen like that. And I can understand that certain exhibitions that I've done, that the works by women, it's not, it's about feminism, but it's in terms of these women just being artists, and the word feminism didn't exist in their thought when they did these works. That's the big difference.
Right, we're going to go to audience in a minute, because I'm sure you've stirred up a lot of things that people want to mention. But I just wonder about this legacy thing. Just take Throbbing Gristle, perhaps, more than specifically your work. Mm. A body of work, a lot of recordings, a lot of live concerts which were recorded. There's hours worth of Throbbing Gristle to be heard. Not all of it is out. Most of it is out there, actually.
Mm.
Assuming for the moment the project has stopped, and there's a very singular good reason why the project has stopped as Throbbing Gristle, what do you think its legacy is? What is it left us with?
I would like to think that it's left people with the thought that the freedom to do something other, to be something other, and the fact that there's value in risk as well. I'd like to think that it gives people freedom to express themselves and not have to just sort of jump in with the, not even the mainstream, because some of the alternative scenes are pretty rigid as well. So to be other, I'd really like to think that was the thing that TG and even my own work and has left behind, is that it's okay to be
other,
and just to be, you know.
We'll unpick the other perhaps before we finish, but I'm going to come back to the audience now, because I'm sure that that's raised a few questions for you. Have we got the roving mic in place, or have I got it? Or is...
Got it there, okay.
I'll
not use this one, I'll look out there. I see a hand over there first, so let's deal with that, and then I'll keep my eyes open for the rest of
it. Hi, it's Pete Roger. I just wanted to ask Cozy something that I saw on the internet the other day, when I was just getting a bit of background to tonight, and there was a website, I think, called Fact, which had an online music magazine, and it had a second annual report as the greatest album of the greatest 100 albums of all time. I wondered, would something like that make you feel proud or embarrassed, or how would you feel about something like that? Kind of a mainstream
just
like reaction to a really non-mainstream.
How did that happen? I don't know.
Proud, embarrassed?
Not embarrassed, no. I'm just surprised. And I think in some ways it's a good thing, because it shows that what we did actually meant something. So I don't know if the word proud is something. No, I don't feel proud of it. I'm pleased. I suppose I could say pleased, amused. Just how, you know, yeah, like, how did it happen? But it's, yeah, when I listen to that now, I quite enjoy listening to it now. So I can understand that within, what, it took 30 years, but hey, that's okay.
Okay, there's one over there. Somebody I can't quite see.
Hi, Cozy. As a young 15-year-old, I was given a copy of this slightly unnerving album called 20 Jazz Funk Greats, and it was the least jazz funk album I'd ever heard. So that was the whole point. What was the story behind them? Were you trying to just reverse everybody's expectations?
In a way, because I think by that point, the scene in London, they kind of like taken us on as their little, you know, oh, let's go and see Throbbing Gristle, I hear they're outrageous. So we wanted to sort of like do something people wouldn't expect. And also, it was ironic sense of humour that to take that cover and think of it as all like just like all the ones that you'd see in the bargain bin in Woolworths that were still around then. And you'd sort of look and it'd be like a Val Doonican cover or something. And it was usually something like, you know, greatest jazz funk greats. And it's totally unexpected for Throbbing Gristle, and that's why we did it, yeah. But the music is nothing like that, obviously. Yeah.
No, it has a profound effect. And I suppose the other thing which kind of always thought, like the gentleman mentioned over there, was that, do you think that Throbbing Gristle, as much as, do you think you give them the credit for how influential a band you've been?
Do you
think Throbbing Gristle are given the credit for being as influential as they are?
I don't think about that, really.
No, that's fair enough.
Yeah.
Okay, right, let's see another question. Yes, down there. Let's get the microphone over there. Okay.
Tell me after.
Do you think you're sleazy as well as sleazy being sleazy?
Do you think you're sleazy as well as sleazy being sleazy?
I met him as well.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about sleazy.
Did he have his t-shirt? It's not easy being sleazy.
He just is.
Yeah, he just is, yeah. Oh, right, yeah.
Mention a bit about sleazy, really, because, I mean, he's not turned up quite so much in this as I might have expected. It was very special, wasn't it? It was a very special contribution. In what way was it special?
Well, yeah, I first met him in, 73 or 74, after the first coming of age, and he did walk up very sleazily. That's where he got his name from, and took photographs of us at the show, and then came to do the hardcore version of Coming of Age in Amsterdam, because we'd heard that Amsterdam was a bit more liberal, so we could do things a little bit more extreme there. But yeah, he was very special. I can't really explain. Sleazy had a thing about he compartmentalised his life. So he had all these different worlds going on at the same time. And he hated them mixing up. And I used to like mixing them up because I used to like seeing him struggle a little bit because he really thought that he had control over it. And he didn't at all, really. So, yeah, in his, when we had his memorial, I brought all those worlds together because not everyone knew each other. And yet we were all grieving for him, and I thought it was really important to do that. So, we had his real biological family, which a lot of Coil fans, I was led to believe that they thought he wasn't even speaking to them, but he was very close to them. So that was a revelation for people. So after he died, everybody got to know quite a little bit more about Sleazy.
Thanks to you.
Yeah, possibly, yeah. I just thought it was important that everybody came together at that point.
Can I just make the point? Sorry, I'll come back to the question in a minute, but you've always had that function of bringing people together. There are times when the explosive nature of Throbbing Gristle in the book comes across to me as you're the person who kind of helped it to still just about cohere. Are you aware of that?
Yeah, I think that I'll say this one. Once. I think it's because I am a woman. It's the thing with working with guys like that is that they were all of them, their emotions would kind of lock down when things got tough. And they'd just go off, like in one particular instance, they just all went off. And I was just left in Beck Road, and I'm thinking, the best thing to do is to just admit something and just talk about it. We'd had a huge argument. But yeah, you have to bring it all together again, and that emotional side was hard to pull out of people. Yeah, definitely. But so yeah, I mean, Sleazy was very, very tender-hearted. He was one thing in Coil, one thing in TG, one thing working for Hypnosis, and when we regrouped again, and he used to come and stay with us in Norfolk. He was. It's nice to be able to be with someone so close to someone that they just completely relax and it's the first time I'd seen Sleazy ever do that when we regrouped. He was completely happy.
I like the word happy. We need more of it. Right, questions. Let's have a little look out there. Has anybody else got any questions? Because I've got a couple more. Dumbfounded. That's all right. If anybody's not, if you do, Cosie's going to be around after, don't forget she's going to be signing a book.
Why didn't Jeff Rushton contribute to it all?
to TG.
To the whole mail of Cozy and TG.
I'd left before Psychic TV was formed, so I don't know about that period. But he got in touch with us before TG ended anyway, so I'd met him a few times, but he became Sleazy's boyfriend pretty quick. And after TG split, and then after Jeff and Sleazy left and started Coil on their own, we sort of connected together again. So, yeah, I was quite close to Jeff as well, and his drunken phone calls. And, yeah, 2-hour-long phone calls. But yeah, he was really troubled.
I'll ask a question. That might give you a chance to think. There are times reading the book when you say things like, "And we thought about reforming, or we thought about doing this," and I want to say, "Cozy, don't do it." Don't do that. I can see that you should not do that because that's going to have consequences.
Like what?
Well, I don't know. It depends what it was. You know, yeah, there was a lot of stuff in there. I think, you know, don't. But you still did, and you still put yourself through an awful lot of stuff. Mm. Is there anything that you would like to say to your younger self about what they did then?
No. I don't know.
No?
I don't see the point of that, no. Because that'd be more like, that's like inverting the questions, anything you regret, possibly. And I don't regret anything because it's brought me where I am now, and I'm pretty good where I am now.
Okay. I mean, I wondered because there are times in the book when, I mean, this is a book where you don't regret. You know, where there's a shred of regret in the whole book, is there? Everything that I did. I said at the beginning it was a book about working very hard. It was, I mean, we were talking earlier, weren't we, in the Punk Survivors section about the, you know, what makes for what we did. There was the DIY thing. But were you consciously working very hard at something during that period? Were you... I mean, sometimes it's so driven, the things you're doing, that I suspect that I got the feeling that you really did want something to happen.
No, there wasn't the conscious thought of that. It's just that it was all happening at once, and I couldn't control that, and I didn't want to control that because it was coming together because of that very thing. Is that, you know, I knew I had to work to earn money if I had a day job at any different, at any certain point. Because we had a studio and a house. We had a subsidised house, which was a squat that we got turned over for, I think it was like about £5 a week or something. Ridiculous. But to do the art, we had to have those facilities. And to make sure that we kept them, I would go out and work sometimes. We'd use the money from some of the sex magazine work. We got a couple of Arts Council grants. We didn't get anywhere near the papers said that we got. But I was just working and doing my art. That was my daily life. So, it was hard work. It was really hard work. But I never thought of it as hard work. I just kept thinking, you know, I was so tired. So, obviously, it was hard work. And it was what I wanted to do. It was my life, and I loved doing it. And there were moments when I'd go out and I'd think, I really don't want to do this, especially with the sex stuff. And I'd think, well, why am I doing it? And why would I not do it if I have this opportunity? I could actually learn something from this opportunity rather than just saying, no, I don't want to do that. I've run away from this, run away from that. That wasn't my mindset at the time. My mindset was to go out and meet challenges head on. And if I did it once, I wouldn't have to do it again. Or I might find out that I liked it, so I want to do it again. It's all about discovery. It's not about kind of limiting my life experience. I just wanted everything all at once, so it was hard work.
Because I'd said it on page 136 of the book that you're all going to buy. There's this thing about art is life, life is art, and everybody's an artist and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But the quote is, art is life was tough going.
Mm.
So, no regrets, but what was tough about it? What is tough about art is life?
What was tough is that because my art was my life, literally, then everything I did, I didn't have to justify it, but it was part of my work. So I would go out and I'd have to think about doing that, and I would have to commit to doing it. And the way I went about it would affect the finished piece. So I had to be almost free and release my control over things, which is really hard to do, like in the instances when I'd go and challenge myself. And that was the hard work of it. And the other hard work of it was being so independent and having to get everything done yourself, because we couldn't go out and pay for it. I had no notion and no wish to have art as a career or any kind of job as accountancy, although I was qualified to do accounts, to have that as a career. I would go out and work, and that was work, to subsidise my art. But the whole thing with doing that was that you would meet people, and it wasn't about me doing a painting about a group of people or an event. It was being part of that event, being a part of those people's lives, and that was my art. Wherever I went, whether I worked in a factory or I did a wages clerk or I did a sex action, I was out there with people gaining different information and feelings and emotions that I wouldn't have got had I not done it. And that all fed into my art. And that was, and it was my life. Everyone I came across and everything I did all fed into my art and then manifest in some way.
We finished the last panel with this question about, you know, what would you say to people who were trying to keep their head up high now. Nobody apparently in the previous panel wanted to be a punk survivor, possibly even not me. And so I'm not actually asking you to speak as either a punk or a survivor, but I just think that probably what you've just said is something of a recipe for carrying on. And I wonder if there's anything you'd add to that as a kind of either a mantra or a thought about...
I think that, yeah,
keeping going.
For me, I have to feel a sense of fulfilment in my life, and if I don't feel that, then I know that something isn't right. And that's how I've always lived. That I have to feel fulfilled, and I have a compulsion to create. I can't stop it. I can't live any other way. I don't know how to explain it to anyone.
We started off in Hull.
Mm.
That was our first bit of conversation, really. Was there anything about that period that created your compulsion to create?
I don't know. We're getting into psychoanalysis now, I think.
No, I don't want to do that.
No.
I mean, you had a dad who said no all the time, a dad who was very constricting.
That's what I mean. I think that probably had a lot to do with it, was that he was trying to hold me down and I was trying, constantly pinging up again and refusing, for sure. Yeah, I don't know where that came from. I really have no idea. But I did know, I mean, I know my family... they're quite an extraordinary family, really. I found out other things lately that I never knew. But one thing that was funny is that I found out at my dad's funeral, his younger brother said to me, I don't know if he knew about the magazine work I'd done, but he said, you know, your Aunt Molly, she ran a knocking shop in World War II, you know that, don't you, in Hull. I went, no. And I thought, Chris, that's where it's come from.
But it's not... Well, I mean, this has been a night where people have been invited to think backwards and have very largely not wanted to. Don said earlier on, you know, I don't want to be seen as a punk rock survivor, I want to be as a punk rock success.
Mm.
And, I mean, the same thing for you, I think. I mean, we have gone back over certain episodes. And before we finish, I suppose I invite you to consider whether there is any other episode that we haven't so far mentioned that is indelibly printed in you as a, you know, over those 60 plus years. Were there is there? I mean, we could take, for example, the Priora that came over the ICA exhibition, as one of those kind of signal moments. But is it that, or, you know, if you could only keep one, what might it be?
I think it was when TG ended the first time.
Yeah?
Yeah. Because that was when my life really sort of became free. And that it just was like, I don't know, there was a lot of light after then.
Okay, I don't want to leave on that one. I think I want a bit of light, I want a bit of happiness. Thank you, Cosi, very much. Thank you. Will you give a big round of applause?
Thank you.